Chapter 5. To hear what he had to tell. All three would be slightly embarrassed by Newland's presence, now that his prospective relation to the Mingott clan had been made known, and the young man waited with an amused curiosity to see how they would turn the difficulty. They began, obliquely, by talking about Mrs. Lemuel Struthers. "It's a pity the Beauforts asked her," Mrs. Archer said gently. "But then Regina always does what he tells her, and Beaufort, certain nuances escape Beaufort," said Mr. Jackson, cautiously inspecting the broiled shad, and wondering for the thousandth time why Mrs. Archer's cook always burnt the roe to a cinder. Newland, who had long shared his wonder, could always detect it in the older man's expression of melancholy disapproval.
"Oh, necessarily. Beaufort is a vulgar man," said Mrs. Archer. "Why, Grandfather Newland always used to say to my mother, don't let that fellow Beaufort be introduced to the girls. But at least he's had the advantage of associating with gentlemen. In England too, they say. It's all very mysterious." She glanced at Janie and paused. She and Janie knew every fold of the Beaufort mystery, but in public Mrs. Archer continued to assume that the subject was not one for the unmarried. "But this Mrs. Struthers," Mrs. Archer continued. "What did you say she was, Sillerton?"
"Out of a mine.
Or rather out of the saloon at the head of the pit. Then with living wax works, touring New England. After the police broke that up, they say she lived." Mr. Jackson in his turn glanced at Janie, whose eyes began to bulge from under her prominent lids. There were still hiatuses for her in Mrs. Struthers's past. "Then," Mr. Jackson continued, and Archer saw he was wondering why no one had told the butler never to slice cucumbers with a steel knife, "then Lemuel Struthers came along. They say his advertiser used the girl's head for the shoe polish posters. Her hair's intensely black, you know, the Egyptian style. Anyhow, he eventually married her. There were volumes of innuendo in the way that eventually was spaced, and each syllable given its due stress.
Oh, well, at the pass we've come to nowadays, it doesn't matter," said Mrs. Archer indifferently. The ladies were not really interested in Mrs. Struthers just then. The subject of Ellen Olenska was too fresh and too absorbing to them. Indeed, Mrs. Struthers' name had been introduced by Mrs. Archer, only that she might presently be able to say, "Andy Newland's new cousin, Countess Olenska? Was she at the ball too?" There was a faint touch of sarcasm in the reference to her son, and Archer knew it, and had expected it. Even Mrs. Archer, who was seldom unduly pleased with human events, had been altogether glad of her son's engagement. Especially after that silly business with Mrs. Rushworth, as S.E. had remarked to Janie, alluding to what had once seemed to Newland a tragedy, of which his soul would always bear the scar. "There was no better match in New York than May Welland, look at the question from whatever point you chose. Of course such a marriage was only what Newell, and was entitled to, but young men are so foolish and incalculable and some women, so ensnaring and unscrupulous that it was nothing short of a miracle, to see one's only son safe past the Siren Isle, and in the haven of a blameless domesticity." All this Mrs. Archer felt, and her son knew she felt. But he knew also that as he had been perturbed by the premature announcement of his engagement, or rather by its cause, and it was for that reason, because on the whole he was a tender and indulgent master, that he had stayed at home that evening. "'Tis not that I don't approve of the Mingott's esprit de corps, but why Newland's engagement should be mixed up with that Olenska woman's comings and goings I don't see," Mrs. Archer grumbled to Janie, the only witness of her slight lapses from perfect sweetness. As he had behaved beautifully, and in beautiful behavior she was unsurpassed during the call on Mrs. Welland, but Newland knew, and his betrothed doubtless guessed, that all through the visit she and Janie were nervously on the watch for Madame Olenska's possible intrusion, and when they left the house together as he had permitted herself to say to her son, "I'm thankful that Augusta Welland received us alone.
These indications of inward disturbance moved Archer the more, that he too felt that the Mingots had gone a little too far. But, as it was against all the rules of their code, that the mother and son should ever allude to what was uppermost in their thoughts, he simply replied, "Oh, well, there's always a phase of family parties to be gone through when one gets engaged, and the sooner it's over the better." At which his mother merely pursed her lips under the lace veil that hung down from her gray velvet bonnet trimmed with frosted grapes. Her revenge, he felt her lawful revenge would be, to draw Mr. Jackson, that evening on the Countess Olenska, and, having publicly done his duty as a future member of the Mingott clan, the young man had no objection to hearing the lady discussed in private except that the subject was already beginning to bore him. Mr. Jackson had helped himself to a slice of the tepid filet which the mournful butler had handed him with a look as skeptical as his own, and had rejected the mushroom sauce after a scarcely perceptible sniff. He looked baffled and hungry, and Archer reflected that he would probably finish his meal on Ellen Olenska. Mr. Jackson leaned back in his chair, and glanced up at the candlelit Archers, Newlands and van der Luydens hanging in dark frames on the dark walls. "Ah, how your grandfather Archer loved a good dinner, my dear Newland," he said, his eyes on the portrait of a plump, full-chested young man in a stock and a blue coat, with a view of a white-columned country house behind him. Well. I wonder what he would have said to all these foreign marriages." Mrs. Archer ignored the allusion to the ancestral cuisine and Mr. Jackson continued with deliberation. "No, she was not at the ball." "Ah," Mrs. Archer murmured, in a tone that implied, "he had that decency." "Perhaps the Beauforts don't know her," Janie suggested, with her artless malice. Mr. Jackson gave a faint sip, as if he had been tasting invisible Madeira. "Mrs. Beaufort may not, but Beaufort certainly does, for she was seen walking up Fifth Avenue this afternoon with him by the whole of New York." "Mercy," moaned Mrs. Archer, evidently perceiving the uselessness of trying to ascribe the actions of foreigners to a sense of delicacy. "I wonder if she wears a round hat or a bonnet in the afternoon," Janie speculated. "T'y no s he had on dark blue velvet, perfectly plain and flat like a nightgown." "Janie," said her mother, and Miss Archer blushed and tried to look audacious. "It was, at any rate, in better taste not to go to the ball," Mrs. Archer continued. A spirit of perversity moved her son to rejoin. "Don't think it was a question of taste with her. May said she meant to go, and then decided that the dress in question wasn't smart enough." Mrs. Archer smiled at this confirmation of her inference. "Poor Ellen," she simply remarked, adding compassionately, "he must always bear in mind what an eccentric bringing up Medora Manson gave her. What can you expect of a girl who was allowed to wear black satin at her coming out ball?" "Ah, don't I remember her in it," said Mr. Jackson, adding, "poor girl," in the tone of one who, while enjoying the memory, had fully understood at the time what the sight portended. "It's odd," Janie remarked, "that she should have kept such an ugly name as Ellen. I should have changed it to Elaine." She glanced about the table to see the effect of this. Her brother laughed. "Hi, Elaine? I don't know. It sounds more Polish," said Janie, blushing. "It sounds more conspicuous, and that can hardly be what she wishes," said Mrs. Archer distantly. "Why not?" broke in her son, growing suddenly argumentative. "Why shouldn't she be conspicuous if she chooses? Why should she slink about, as if it were she who had disgraced herself? She's back poor Ellen certainly, because he had the bad luck to make a wretched marriage, but I don't see that that's a reason for hiding her head, as if she were the culprit." "That, I suppose," said Mr. Jackson, speculatively, "is the line the Mingots mean to take." The young man reddened. "Didn't have to wait for their cue, if that's what you mean, sir. Madame Olenska has had an unhappy life. That doesn't make her an outcast. There are rumors, began Mr. Jackson, glancing at Janie.
Oh, I know. The secretary, the young man took him up.
Nonsense, mother. Janie's grown up.
They say, don't they, he went on, that the secretary helped her to get away from her brute of a husband, who kept her practically a prisoner.
Well, what if he did?
I hope there isn't a man among us who wouldn't have done the same in such a case.
Mr. Jackson glanced over his shoulder, to say to the sad butler,
oops.
Dot dot that sauce dot 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 just a little, after all then, having helped himself, he remarked.
I'm told she's looking for a house.
She means to live here.
I hear she means to get a divorce, said Janie boldly.
I hope she will, Archer exclaimed. The word had fallen like a bombshell in the pure and tranquil atmosphere of the Archer dining room. Mrs. Archer raised her delicate eyebrows in the particular curve that signified.
He butler and the young man, himself mindful of the bad taste of discussing such intimate matters in public, hastily branched off into an account of his visit to old Mrs. Mingott. After dinner, according to immemorial custom, Mrs. Archer and Janie trailed their long silk draperies up to the drawing room, where, while the gentlemen smoked below stairs, they sat beside a carcel lamp with an engraved globe, facing each other across a rosewood work table with a green silk bag under it, and stitched at the two ends of a tapestry band of field flowers destined to adorn an occasional chair in the drawing-room of young Mrs. Newland Archer. While this rite was in progress in the drawing room, Archer settled Mr. Jackson in an armchair near the fire in the Gothic library, and handed him a cigar. Mr. Jackson sank into the armchair with satisfaction, lit his cigar with perfect confidence it was Newland who bought them, and stretching his thin old ankles to the coals, said,
"Who say the secretary merely helped her to get away, my dear fellow?
Well, he was still helping her a year later then, for somebody met him living at Lawson together."
Newland reddened.
"Ivan together?
Well, why not?
Who had the right to make her life over, if as he hadn't?
I'm sick of the hypocrisy that would bury alive a woman of her age, if her husband prefers to live with harlots."
He stopped and turned away angrily to light a cigar.
"Omen ought to be free as we are," he declared, making a discovery of which he was too irritated to measure the terrific consequences.
Mr. Sillerton Jackson stretched his ankles nearer the coals, and emitted a sardonic whistle.
"Well," he said after a pause, "apparently Count Olenskaya takes your view, for I never heard of his having lifted a finger to get his wife back."
"Why?"
That evening, after Mr. Jackson had taken himself away, and the ladies had retired to their chintz-curtained bedroom, Newland Archer mounted thoughtfully to his own study. A vigilant hand had, as usual, kept the fire alive, and the lamp trimmed, and the room, with its rows and rows of books, its bronze and steel statuettes of the fencers on the mantelpiece, and its many photographs of famous pictures, looked singularly home-like and welcoming. As he dropped into his armchair near the fire, his eyes rested on a large photograph of May Welland, which the young girl had given him in the first days of their romance, and which had now displaced all the other portraits on the table. With a new sense of awe, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.